clearly you've got an intelligence involved with the phenomenon. And it seems apparent to me that one of the items on their agenda in terms of their interaction at this point in human history is quite clearly connected to nuclear weapons. If, you know, worse came to worse, and we and some other country, either China or Russia, do at some point in our future decide to go to war and use nuclear weapons, whether or not the same kinds of disruptions that have been reported at various Air Force bases and so on could be affected worldwide so that every nuclear missile launch could be interfered with, I don't presume to know. And I suspect that the Pentagon and CIA and the Kremlin and the successor to the KGB probably don't have a clue either.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 2. It is June 16th, 2007. This week, our guest is Robert Hastings. He's going to be talking about the UFO nuke connection. Anyone who has more than just a peripheral knowledge of the UFO phenomenon knows that there is a certain strange trend that has shown itself over the years with regards to UFO sightings, and that is UFO sightings over nuclear missile bases. Well, Robert Hastings has spent the last 30 years cultivating and investigating these very cases. He's going to bring his lofty research here to the program in this interview and share with us his take on this strange subsection of ufology. We're going to find out about his background, how he decided to focus on the UFO nuke connection, key cases like the Malmstrom Air Force Base case of 1967 and the Big Sur case of 1964. Also, cases involving various levels of UFOs tampering with nuclear weapons, from regular surveillance to causing the equipment to malfunction, all the way to possibly setting into motion the actual launch sequence. We're going to have some big picture speculation on what it all might mean and some great observations from Robert on ufology. It's jam-packed with some really riveting information from Robert Hastings, who has really carved out a fantastic niche here studying UFOs and nuclear bases. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Robert Hastings, let me give a little bit of background on him. Robert Hastings was born at Sandia Base, New Mexico, May 6, 1950, during a period of high UFO activity at the base and nearby Kirtland Air Force Base. His father, Sergeant Robert E. Hastings, was career Air Force, and the Hastings family were stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1966-67 during one of the peak periods of UFO activity at nearby ICBM sites. That's what sparked his interest in UFOs. He received his BFA in photography at Ohio University in 1972. He almost completed a master's program in instructional technology, media directed toward educational ends, but gave that up in 1981 to go out on the college lecture circuit to speak on the UFO nukes connection. Thus far, he has spoken at over 500 colleges and universities nationwide. In 1986 to 1988, he retrained in electron microscopy at San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton, California, and received a certificate in material science applications. Between 1988 and 2002, he was employed as a laboratory analyst by Philips Semiconductors in Albuquerque, Mexico, but continued to lecture at colleges part-time, averaging 25 to 30 programs per year. He is currently semi-retired, but still lectures on UFOs. Unfortunately, Robert does not have a website, but if you go to the page where you found this interview at banalofamerica.com, you'll find three great links to articles written by Robert Hastings that we discussed throughout this interview. You can link up to those at the page, and you'll be able to get tons more material from Robert Hastings regarding his research. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll, folks. This interview was recorded on May 30th, 2007. Robert Hastings, talking about the UFO nukes connection. on Banal of America Audio, Season 2.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. This week, our guest is Robert Hastings, who has been studying the UFO phenomenon for over 30 years. He's just done an amazing amount of work, and he's focused on the UFO-nukes connection, nuclear weapons, that is, and the strange situation with UFO sightings over nuclear bases, not just in America, but also all over the world. And what's going on with that connection? And that's what we're going to talk about with Robert Hastings. And we're also going to find out a little bit about his travels in the world of ufology over the years and how he thinks things are shaping up in the UFO field. So welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you.
Well, let's start out first, obviously, with your bio and your background, how you gravitated toward the UFO subject in the first place.
My father was career Air Force, and in 1966 and 67, he was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana. Many of your listeners probably already know that there were a number of now well-publicized UFO sightings at the base, Minuteman nuclear weapons sites during that period. I happened to actually see five UFOs on radar, five targets. At the time, I was 16 going on 17 and worked as a custodian in the base air traffic control tower. And I did actually witness with my own eyes, according to the FAA controller who was talking to me, that these objects were clearly not aircraft, and that jet fighters had been launched to investigate. When I excitedly mentioned all of this to my father, he made inquiries, unbeknownst to me, actually, but later told me that there was confirmation, probably third hand at that point, that indeed these were bona fide UFOs maneuvering near silos, missile installations out at a location called Judith Basin, a county with a number of missile silos. So that was my introduction to the subject. I was quite fascinated and intrigued by what I witnessed and what I was subsequently told. And by 1973, I was enamored enough of the subject that I decided to begin interviewing former and retired Air Force personnel regarding their own experiences, not only at Malmstrom, but at other Air Force bases. I was interested in any type of incident involving UFOs, but very quickly came to focus on sightings involving nuclear weapons.
What made you decide to focus on that nuclear aspect? Obviously, people who follow the UFO phenomenon know about how intricate that is to the UFO phenomenon, but a lot of people, it's sort of under the radar, with a lot for, no pun intended, I guess, in the mainstream, really, I guess. But what made you focus on the nuclear aspect of the UFO phenomenon?
Well, it seemed to me self-evident that, especially for anyone who grew up in the Cold War era, that the threat of nuclear war seemed to always be hanging over our heads. I remember in elementary school and even high school at Air Force bases having regular atomic bomb drills, nuclear bomb drills, where we would have to duck under desks. I think that went on nationwide, especially during the 1950s. So there was always this threat that we were going to engage in thermonuclear war with the Soviet Union and, you know, conceivably could end human civilization if indeed something like that transpired. So the fact that UFOs seem to be interested in nosing around, surveilling whatever, our nuclear weapons seemed to me very significant. And very quickly I came to the conclusion that probably one of the primary reasons that UFO sightings accelerated dramatically post-World War II was the fact that we had nuclear weapons. By probably the mid-70s, I became aware of the writings of Captain Edward Ruppelt, who was the first chief of Project Blue Book. In his book, published in 1956, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, Ruppelt made a number of explicit statements about UFOs flying around nuclear weapons sites, ranging from the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Lab to Sandia Base in Albuquerque, where coincidentally I was born, and other nuclear weapons-related facilities, the Oak Ridge National Laboratories, where weapons-grade uranium and plutonium was produced, where also at the Hanford site in Washington, where plutonium was produced for nuclear weapons. So even the Air Force was very aware of and concerned by nuclear weapons-related sightings as of the late 1940s and early 50s. So it seemed to me that whatever else UFOs are up to, one of the principal themes, the more and more I dug into it, it seemed to be involving nuclear weapons.
And you said you started in 73 starting to interview these whistleblowers, for lack of a better term. How did you find people to speak out on what they saw while they were in the military? That sounds like it would be a hard nut to crack. So how did you find these people? And then, you know, how did you go about figuring out what they had to say?
Well, you're absolutely correct. I would say, you know, 1 out of 20 or 1 out of 50 people actually had something significant to say to me. However, given that my background was Air Force and the fact that my dad was career, I had a number of acquaintances through him and other persons I came into contact with who had Air Force backgrounds, of course, either active duty or retired. So I just began informally asking questions of people. Not surprisingly, most of the people I spoke with had no knowledge of anything involving UFOs, or at least that's what they told me. I think most of them were sincere. My gut told me clearly that some of them were being deceptive, but I viewed that as their prerogative, and I didn't really push the issue, with rare exceptions. At some point in time, there began to be a groundswell of responses, probably by about the mid-70s, where people were discussing with me their knowledge of one incident or another involving UFOs. Radar operators were discussing objects being tracked that could not be identified as aircraft by their velocities, their erratic maneuvers, some cases objects doing performing maneuvers that no aircraft on Earth could match. So the people who were telling me these stories were quite impressed themselves by what they had witnessed. I also began discussing or asking persons with a knowledge of nuclear weapons cases to elaborate as to their knowledge of these events. These people were very tight-lipped, with rare exceptions, but at some point when I began summarizing formally my interviews and providing these people with the interview summaries, a number of them seemed to be relieved that other people were talking about these events, and more or less went on the record either more or less specifically. And I'm talking about, at this point, several hundred persons, former and retired Air Force personnel, by this point in time, 2007, who've discussed various issues with me. Some of the individuals are extremely explicit. For example, then Lieutenant Robert Salas was a nuclear missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base during the same period when my dad was there. Salas has gone online with his research associate, Jim Klotz, and have just laid out chapter and verse what occurred at Malmstrom at his particular launch control facility. Salas was underground with his co-commander, and when they got a frantic call from a guard topside at ground level saying, "Sir, there's a UFO hovering over the site," Salas has said he thought this was a joke and was kind of indignant that this guard would make jokes over this very secure line. And he said, "Well, just, you know, keep me informed." Minutes later, the same guard called back and was frantic, if not scared, and said, "Sir, it's directly over the site, and one of the guards has been injured. Salas said he had not even the time to wake up his co-commander to explain what was going on, when suddenly on their missile readiness display panel in the underground launch capsule, they observed that one by one, the 10 Minuteman missiles that they themselves controlled would launch in the time of war began to malfunction one after the other, what the Air Force calls dropping off alert status. Long story short, Salas was debriefed by what's called OSI, the Office of Special Investigations, was sworn to secrecy, and did not tell his story until 1995, when he began working with Jim Klotz. So that's the type of incident that I've heard about from not only Salas, but other individuals, objects hovering directly over nuclear missile launch control facilities. In some instances, not all, but in some instances, missiles malfunction immediately thereafter. Interestingly, the missile maintenance personnel I've talked to have described described cases where apparently targeting tapes or other types of targeting technology has been scrambled in effect, and following these incidents requiring sometimes the complete removal of those particular missiles and replacement with others. So obviously this is some very dramatic stuff, and the sources are persons that the U.S. government has entrusted with the launching of nuclear weapons or the guarding of nuclear weapons, the maintenance of nuclear weapons, persons who are given psychological tests, persons who are considered obviously trustworthy in these very dramatic circumstances of launching missiles in time of war, potentially killing millions of people. I mean, these are people who are not your average Joe on the street, and they're speaking of incidents involving UFOs hovering above their missiles and in some cases apparently tampering with their missiles' functionality. So, in my view, this is self-evidently important and something that I've just really devoted my adult life to investigating.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, kudos to you for compiling that many solid witnesses. Those are witnesses of good stock, as you say. You know, these aren't the proverbial farmer in the hayfield. These are legit people who, you know, how can you not believe? And I see also that you've sort of tried to supplement some of your witness testimony with Freedom of Information requests and document type searches. It sounds like that's the sort of thing that's actually not too easy, because these sort of things are kind of scrubbed from the record. How easy or hard is it to get information via the government regarding these incidents?
I began filing Freedom of Information requests in the early 1980s, and what I found very quickly is that my responses were essentially no response at all. I tried to get Air Force Office of Special Investigations records based on the testimony of my sources saying that on such and such a date at such and such a base, this incident occurred and I was debriefed by OSI. Well, according to OSI, in response to my Freedom of Information requests, they had zero documents relating to the incidents that I was petitioning for. They basically had the blanket statement, all files, OS files, OSI files relating to UFO sightings were declassified when Project Blue Book files were declassified. That is not the case. And so what I've decided to do over the years is concentrate on the witness interviews.
Yeah.
Simply because I just think that I'm not going to get anywhere else. Some of my research associates, Jim Klotz, for example, has filed FOIA requests on my behalf. He's gotten nowhere with OSI and other agencies that might have a knowledge of these nuclear weapons-related cases. So we think the stonewalling is such that we're not going to get anywhere, basically. Nevertheless, over the years, Dr. Bruce McAbee, for example, succeeded in getting a number of FBI documents relating to nuclear weapons cases that the FBI were privy to back in the late 40s and early 50s, pretty much before they were cut out by the Air Force. There was a lot of sharing of information about the early UFO sightings in New Mexico at the Los Alamos Labs, Sandia Labs in Albuquerque, other Oak Ridge, Hanford, other sites, and the documents also clearly indicate that CIA took an interest, a strong interest, and perhaps even a controlling interest in these types of events. But the record, the paperwork, the paper trail is fragmentary. What is known is pretty hit or miss, and events from about the mid-60s on, early 60s even, the paper trail just dries up with rare exceptions involving the nuclear weapons related cases. So it's a very tightly guarded secret. It obviously has national security related implications, and I think the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies who are monitoring the situation, gathering the data and suppressing the data, have just concluded that, you know, all of this will be beyond Freedom of Information release.
Yeah. And we had a special episode actually about a month ago with Paul Kimball. He did a cable special, 10 best UFO cases, and a lot of them were in one of them obviously was the Maelstrom one, and many of them also were kind of in this vein with military type witnesses and radar returns and that kind of thing. And obviously these must be the cream of the crop, so I can see why the government will want to keep them under wraps.
I think that's true. I think there are any number of sources who are willing to come forward and talk about what they know, but again, backing it up with documentation has been extremely difficult. Bob Salas, by the way, the gentleman I mentioned who was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 67, is going to be one of the key speakers at the MUFON conference in Denver in August. And I strongly recommend that anybody attending the conference attend Mr. Salas's lecture, because he will stick to the nuts and bolts. He obviously has credentials. And whereas a lot of other research into UFOs involves a great deal of speculation, Mr. Salas will just tell you chapter and verse what occurred to him and what took place. There are, to my knowledge, at least five other former or retired missile launch officers at Malmstrom who've also gone on the record about the incidents that Mr. Salas is willing to describe. All of them are pretty reticent. They're certainly not as willing to go full out as Mr. Salas is in terms of publicizing their experiences, but they have gone on the record as to those experiences occurring and their knowledge of them. For example, I about 5 or 6 years ago interviewed a man named, Bob Jamieson, who was at the time of the Malmstrom incidents a missile targeting officer. Who was actually in charge of making sure that in time of war the missiles would land where they were designated to land. He said that he was personally involved in at least two separate UFO-related missile shutdowns where large numbers of Minuteman missiles malfunctioned simultaneously, precisely at a time, just moments later after reports of UFOs above their positions came in to the launch officers. And you know, so these are persons that have some credentials, obviously know what they're talking about, and they're willing to go on the record finally about these things occurring.
And how do you overcome the problem? And we've talked about this on the show with ufologists, especially people who work with the whistleblowers, of ufology sort of turning on the whistleblowers or putting them through the ringer. And a lot of times, you know, the whistleblower at the end of the day will be like, you know, it wasn't worth it because I came up forward with this thing and then the UFO people completely turned on me. Obviously, you don't do that. You're trying to find the whistleblowers. But, I mean, how do you deal with that you know, cannibalistic attitude of ufology?
Well, when I'm interviewing the persons I talk to, the sources that I uncover on occasion just drop in my lap, I myself put them through a rigorous series of questions. I require that they provide their service records to me, substantiating their presence in these squadrons at those bases at the time of the incidents. And I have any number of very probing questions that I ask each and every one of them just to satisfy my own sense that they know what they're talking about and that they're credible. So I make it clear to them that, you know, if they're willing to go on the record with me and if I'm going to publish what they're saying with their permission, then they've got to be able to substantiate as best as possible what they're telling me.
Yeah.
Beyond that, as far as the response of ufology in general or the public in general to these cases, years ago I just adopted the posture of taking what comes, because the whole process has a life of itself. Popular perceptions of UFOs, skeptics and debunkers' perceptions of UFOs, and all of that is nothing that's going to be significantly modified. I think there will always be controversy associated with this subject until once and for all the reality of UFOs is demonstrated beyond any doubt. So I don't let it worry me, or I'm not concerned by the fact that some people will always doubt the validity of this data.
Before I did the research, I had a question for you, and then when I started doing it, it actually sort of answered my question, and that it was that it seemed like these nuclear sightings happened a lot in the past and weren't happening nowadays. But then when I read your report here, let me give the address for the report for people. Get a pen and paper, folks. Here it is. www.nicap.org/Babylon/missile_incidents.htm. And we'll have a link at the page where you find the interview. So hopefully you'll be able to get to the site that we're talking about here that has a paper published by Robert. You have a compendium there of a lot of key cases and sightings over nuclear bases. And what I found interesting and answered the question was one of the first that I had when we were planning the interview was about this later time period of UFO over nuke-based sightings, is that there seems to have been a series of sightings in the 90s over Malmstrom Air Force Base and a few other ones. This isn't a phenomenon that came and went in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It's still kind of going on.
Well, what I found, if one goes online and tries to search Google, for example, for nuclear weapons-related UFO cases, as far as the ICBM cases, the nuclear missile cases, almost probably 80%, just off the top of my head, the majority of the material relates to the incidents that were reported at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1967. Mm-hmm. However, what I have found and other researchers have found who've dug into this in depth is that indeed this is an ongoing situation. Nuclear missiles came online, began to be deployed around 1960, depending on how you use the benchmarks that have been published. But operationally, nuclear missiles took hold, right, or were deployed right around 1960. And I have discovered that even the first generation of nuclear missiles that we use, the Atlas missiles, were visited by UFOs at a number of bases, including Walker Air Force Base in Roswell, New Mexico, F.E. Warren Air Force Base outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and other Atlas bases. So from the get-go, when missiles came online, they were being visited by disc-shaped objects. The article, the online article you just referenced of mine, I have, I think, five or six individuals, launch officers and missile maintenance personnel at Walker Air Force Base, describing saucer-shaped objects hovering over nuclear missile silos, racing away instantaneously at high velocity, and then instantaneously stopping over adjacent missile silos. That information comes from a launch officer named retired Lieutenant Colonel Philip Moore, and so he's one of the people who's gone online about it. Another former launch officer, then Lieutenant Jerry Nelson, has talked about at this one site he was at, site number 9, Atlas site number 9, repeatedly over about a month, he estimated somewhere around half a dozen to a dozen cases, instances rather, where an unlit object hovered silently and directly over the missile silo, but shone a bright light down on it before racing away. And he said the guards were just panic-stricken by this. They couldn't explain what was going on. So the types of events that have been reported at Malmstrom in the late 60s were preceded by events at other bases in the earlier generations of nuclear missile deployment. As you mentioned, I've also interviewed persons, missile maintenance personnel, and others who were involved at Malmstrom with nuclear missiles in the mid-1990s, and indeed they're reporting virtually the same kinds of instances that were going on two decades, three decades earlier. So this is an ongoing process. My opinion, based on what I know of all this after this many years of researching it, is that probably within the last year, somewhere at some nuclear missile base, there was an incident of this type, but it will probably take years for persons to come forward after they've left the Air Force, after they've left active duty, who are willing to discuss these incidents. So there's always this built-in, generally speaking, delay factor. Mm-hmm. But yes, indeed, there are a number of instances of these types of events occurring at various bases in the 1990s.
And then one of the cases that you seem to have paid a little bit of extra attention to in the past few months or whatever, and you sent me an article about it, and maybe we could touch on here. I don't have a lot of like specific case-type questions, but this one I want to touch on. That's the Big Sur case of 1964, because that's almost like a case study of what you do by, you know, finding the whistleblowers and then trying to get past. You do a great job in the article that you sent me. And what magazine was that in?
Oh, it's in the International UFO Reporter, which is the quarterly publication of the Center for UFO Studies, QFOS. If your listeners go online and type in Big Sur UFO. Sur is S-U-R. Big Sur UFO Hastings. You'll find references, actually the entire article reprinted. It's now online. And yes, it's extraordinary. I consider it one of the top half dozen cases that I'm aware of involving UFOs and nuclear weapons that sort of substantiates the reality of it. You've got two key sources, retired Air Force or former or retired Air Force personnel officers, who've gone on the record saying that in September of 1964 at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, an Atlas missile was test launched. It was carrying an experimental payload, a warhead that was designed to release chaff, aluminum chaff, around the warhead up in space, which was designed to confuse Soviet radar defenses so they would not, if they had anti-missile capability and attempted to shoot down the warhead, they would not be able to differentiate between the warhead and the chaff. So that was the purpose of the experiment. The two officers that retired, former retired officers that have gone on record, Robert Jacobs, who was the chief of the photo instrumentation unit at Vandenberg, and another gentleman named Major Florence Mansman, who was one of the chief photo optical interpreters. I don't have his exact title in my mind at the moment, but in any event, these two people have independently confirmed that while they were filming the launch of this missile test, and after the warhead, the dummy warhead, had separated from the booster, they actually picked up on film a UFO coming into camera frame, circling the dummy warhead at four different points, flashing bright lightning bolt types of beams at the warhead, whereupon, according to both officers, the warhead began to tumble and fell into the Pacific Ocean hundreds of miles short of its target. Lieutenant Jacobs has characterized this as, quote, a shot across the bow of our nuclear silliness ship, end quote. And in my view, that just hits the nail right on the head. I think that's exactly what was going on. Somebody, obviously in possession of superior technology, was demonstrating that they had the ability to interfere with nuclear weapons in space, nuclear warheads in space. Now, the organization PSYCOP, the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of them. It's been a UFO debunking group, paranormal debunking group now for decades. They published an article in 1993 by a man named Kingston George, who was also involved with this particular series of launches at Vandenberg. Kingston George claims that Lieutenant Jacobs' report about this incident was totally off base. There was nothing involving UFOs, that in fact they were simply misidentifying what they were observing on film, which was a type of decoy or dummy experiment, and these objects that were being deployed as dummy decoy warheads were misidentified as a UFO. Well, I have personally found, as I described in the article, a number of factual errors. Mr. George just totally misrepresented what Lieutenant Jacobs said about the launch, said about what was captured on film. And in my view, I've totally demolished Mr. George's skeptical debunking assessment of the case. So I think, if for no other reason, persons who are aware of Big Sur and the controversy around it, I think they would find my article quite illuminating in terms of my identifying a number of fundamental errors in the debunking treatment of the case.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll have a link up to I'll Google that up and find it, and we'll have a link up to it on the page with the interview so people can check that out.
Your reference to the other article that I have online at the NICAP.org website, if you search Google simply for UFO ICBM, you'll find it almost immediately.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, we'll have all the links up. Hopefully people will be able to find them and stuff, and I'm sure they will, because we'll make it as readily available as possible. How about a ballpark figure here on how many of these UFO nuclear incidents have you actually, like, discovered at this point? Do you have a number off the top of your head where you think you can put at?
I don't off the top of my head. I mean, if depending on what database we're talking about, reports that were written about in declassified documents as opposed to interviews I've conducted with individuals, I don't know what the total would be. I can tell you that the number of persons that I've interviewed since 1973 who, in my view, are credible witnesses speaking about nuclear weapons-related UFO cases, the number of persons I've interviewed is approximately 60 at this point in time. The number of persons that I've interviewed about UFO sightings in general by Air Force personnel is in the range of several hundred at this point. I wouldn't be able to quantify it for you.
You've talked a lot here about UFOs sort of tinkering with the nukes, messing with the controls or interfering in the tests and that kind of thing. Would you say that that's the predominant overarching theme of these UFO nuclear connection, or would you say that's like more of a small subsection when the UFO gets proactively involved in it? Is it, you know, is that more the norm that the UFO is going to be doing something to the nuke, or is it more often than not they're just surveying what's going on?
Again, I would have difficulty quantifying the ratio. However, I would say the overwhelming majority of the cases that I'm aware of, based on the testimony of these former and retired Air Force personnel, the majority of the cases would simply involve what one might characterize as surveillance, UFO surveillance of nuclear weapons sites. However, there is this subcategory of probably six or seven cases that I'm aware of from these witness interviews where there was actually apparently deliberate, premeditated tampering or interruption of the missile's functionality. One might argue that these are simply incidental incidents, that, for example, the UFO is emanating some sort of field effect which inadvertently interferes with the missile's electronics, thereby causing the malfunction. That's indeed in the realm of possibility, but my opinion and the opinion of the majority of my sources is that no, there was a premeditated, deliberate demonstration by whoever was on board the UFO that indeed they could interfere with our nuclear weapons functionality.